Iowa hasn't been the focus of recent national protests. Still, Iowa's law enforcement officers are feeling some of the effects of the escalated racial tension. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll get the thoughts of Waterloo Police Chief Daniel Trelka, Betty Andrews of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP, and John Godar, president of the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association. Then legal experts Ryan Kopmans and Rox Laird look back at 5 years with the Iowa Supreme Court under Chief Justice Mark Cady. In 2010, Iowans voted against retaining three Iowa Supreme Court justices for their ruling that legalized same-sex marriage. That's all coming up this hour. First, the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. President Obama, we've heard in the news, is in Dallas today to pay tribute to the five police officers who were shot and killed during a deadly sniper attack last week. The president's trip comes amid mounting racial tension across the country over the recent police shootings of black men by police, one in Minnesota and one in Louisiana. And that's just last week. Even though Iowa hasn't been the focus of recent national protests, we wanted to find out this first half hour what ripples are being felt among law enforcement and others in the state. Joining us to do that, Daniel Trelka is with us, Chief of Police in Waterloo. Chief of Police Trelka, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us, Betty Andrews is the president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP. Betty Andrews, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Betty is in our Des Moines studio. John Godar is with us, president of the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association. John, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
I want to go around and just get your reaction. We're very interested in what these past few days have been like for you working in the positions that you do after the five officers were killed by a sniper. Also, of the events leading up to that. Daniel Trelka, what has it been like for you the past few days?
Well, there's been tension on many sides of the issue, but I feel like things are going relatively well in Waterloo, even given all the national events, because we've had a continual and constant dialogue. Matter of fact, I was just communicating with our local president from the NAACP here in Waterloo this morning. And I think that's something that's very important is dialogue, just constant and effective dialogue. It's not going to fix all the problems because we need to admit there are issues and problems we need to address. But if we have that dialogue, we can proceed more easily.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say there's a sense of more tension also in Waterloo. How does that exhibit itself? How are you and how is your force noticing that?
Well, I see it. I like to monitor what's going on with my officers, and that's why I'm on Facebook. Many of them are on Facebook. I get to see how they're feeling through their comments and everything, and they're remaining appropriate, but I can sense the stress in some of the comments they're making. One officer comments, "I just got off from work, and it seems so stressful, and there's a lot of pain in the country and in the community. How do we overcome that?" And even through the video, the squad car videos and the body camera videos, the officers seem to be more on edge, and they're not as their temperament is too high, and I need to monitor that and watch it because that doesn't help when we're trying to de-escalate stressful situations.
Mm-hmm. So what words do you have for members of your force in these tense times?
Be careful, take care of each other, and this community works with us to address it. Waterloo's come a long way over the past 6 years, and I'm proud of that. We haven't had a homicide in Waterloo. We haven't suffered a homicide in almost a year, which I'm very proud of. Our use of force incidents are down 50 to 60% over the past 6 years. So I keep reminding the officers, I said, listen, we've got a lot of work to do. And even in the face of adversity going on throughout the country, we're doing things right here, in my opinion, and we just need to keep forging forward. I'm the face and the leader of this department. Have trust and confidence in me. And that's the message I give the community as well.
Daniel Trelka, your counterpart in Dallas, Dallas Police Chief David Brown, you no doubt have and imagined yourself in his shoes this past week. He has been lauded across the country for taking bold steps to root out bad cops in his force, also to repair relations with minorities in that large community. Do you face some of the same challenges in Waterloo?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's that man's story is incredible. His own son killed a police officer and then is killed by the police. I believe a brother and his partner all died at the hands of gun violence. Just remarkable. And for him to stay the course and just the emotional fortitude he has to have just amazes me. And I think a lot of us can look to him for guidance and how we should. And I'm a news junkie. I like to follow the news because I'm thinking, okay, when I see mistakes and issues occurring in other parts of the country, what can we learn from that to make things better in Waterloo?
Mm-hmm. And what have you, following the news, following Dallas Police Chief David Brown's actions, what have you learned specifically that you might bring to Waterloo?
Well, one thing that really strikes me is it was very bold for him to say, and when he came out and said, listen, help be part of the solution. Join our ranks. Become a police officer. Help us fix this problem in the trenches, in the front lines.
What is it when you say this problem? I guess that's the national dialogue, isn't it? What is this problem?
A lack of dialogue. I think it all starts with society's fragmented. Each side is ticking the other off. Things get inflamed through the media, social media, and people stop with the dialogue. The one thing that I do here in Waterloo to bring us all back to the table, because I've got a difference of opinion with many people in my community, but to blow away the smoke and clear the air, I says, let's go back to, I have a belief that any life that is lost through other than natural means, natural death, is a tragedy. So I want to work hard to make that better. I'd be so happy if everybody could just die of old age. So that's the goal I strive for, and to clear the air when we have our difference of opinions and we're yelling and screaming at each other and we're having these brutal, honest dialogues. I like to go back to just that. Let's go back to that. Let's clear the air and go back to that.
Daniel Trelka is Chief of Police in Waterloo. We're discussing the response to the police shootings, also the most recent shootings of black men by police, one in Minnesota and one in Louisiana. Betty Andrews with us as well, president of the Iowa and Nebraska NAACP. Give us a sense of your last few days.
Absolutely. Well, I was actually on vacation when I came across the video and was alerted to the deaths of Mr. Castillo and Mr. Sterling. And the first, well, I was in one room and I was listening to and watching the videos and looking through news articles about the situation. And literally in tears, I went into the kitchen of where we were staying and I bopped my son on the head. And he looked at me and said, "What was that for?" And I said, in tears, "This is what I have been telling you. This is what I've been working with you on." He's 17. And this is why it is so important that you keep yourself together. And that is the conversation that I've had to have with him, as well as my daughters. That is the conversation that many black mothers have had to have across the country with their children. And it's not a new conversation, but this brings it to light. It is a devastating tragedy to see this type of tension realized. And I also would like to say that definitely our heart goes out to the slain police officers in Dallas. And that was another point of learning for my family in terms of just reminding them of another conversation that we've had all their lives, to respect law enforcement, and that 99.9% of officers are just doing their job. They're going to work and they are there to protect and serve. And so feelings of devastation on all accounts. The community is definitely concerned. I know that since I have returned to the city, to Iowa, I've received a number of calls and requests for a dialogue, and we are going to be hosting a town hall around this issue. Mm-hmm. But the community is outraged, but also understands the need for law enforcement. They are addressing the historical systemic issues that have brought us to this place. And I believe that the conversation has been, and I don't know if you can say that there is a good thing out of this devastation, but certainly having an understanding and having an opportunity to have this dialogue. You know, this dialogue is like a volcano. Some of the things that you're seeing on the surface run much deeper, and that lava is running much deeper. There are a lot of systematic issues that must be addressed in this country, and America does need to have a real conversation about race.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it is, you're pointing to the same thing that Chief of Police Trelka said, a lack of dialogue. I wonder, Iowa...
And I just want to be clear.
Yes.
I'm not just saying a conversation. I know I said conversation, but there are some actions that need to take place. There are some laws that, for instance, racial profiling laws, for instance, having an agency that has consistent accountability, to which law enforcement agencies can have consistent accountabilities. For instance, just continuing to build that community police trust relationship, to also put forth measures to ensure equitable treatment and legitimate policing.
Iowa has not been in the headlines most recently for what has happened and caused the tumult across the country, the racial tension. Betty Andrews, is this very definitely an Iowa problem as well?
Well, I believe, obviously, it's an Iowa problem. Well, for me, it's obvious. When we look at our, the ACLU study that talked about African Americans in our state being 8 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession, even though African Americans and other Iowans use marijuana at the same rate. So there definitely is a proclivity. The other thing that is of concern to us, and this is a part of the bill that the NAACP authored for the legislature this last term that didn't pass, but we're working on it again, is that this notion of pretextual stops. There are situations in which African Americans, even though a busted taillight might be out for a white person versus an African American, the African American is several times more likely to be stopped. So, yes, this is not necessarily an issue of officer shooting, but there are a number of issues that are happening. And my meeting before this was with the Department of Justice, U.S. Attorney, and we talked about how in the last 5 years they've prosecuted about 5 officers here in, I believe, in Iowa. So it definitely is a concern for us.
Betty Andrews of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP. John Godard, let's hear from you, President of the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association. Your thoughts, reflections, now that we've had a few days since the awful events of last week.
Well, Betty and Dan both are right on as far as dialogue and communication. That's key. I think we're fortunate to live in the state of Iowa, where we don't have the problems to the scale that exist in other areas, but we still do have issues that we need to keep in contact about and work on. Betty mentioned the pretextual stops, and there's a lot of numbers, and there's been a lot of discussion in the last year, 2 years, over representation of minorities in the criminal justice system. And there's a lot of reasons for that that explain it other than police misconduct. But certainly everyone in law enforcement has admitted you're going to have cases where an officer does the wrong thing, acts inappropriately. What's frustrating to me is when that happens, it's overrepresented to the point that an isolated incident looks like an epidemic. And and that's part of the day and age we are now. Social media, things are out there immediately, and there's a very quick rush to judgment before all the facts are viewed and looked at. And people are hurting right now on both sides of this issue. Law enforcement, I can tell you, in the last several days, you know, the people I talk to, they're struggling because they're angry. They want to do their job and they want to do it well, but they feel that they're kind of out in the cold here. And what one just said to me the other day is just, you know, nobody likes being accused of being a racist. And when that happens, that something happens nationally and it gets played so much, that's the message that gets sent out. So it's frustrating for the officers involved as well. You know, we wouldn't want to call a cop evil, all cops evil, because of the actions of one any more than we'd want to try to categorize African Americans because of the actions of one.
John Goddard, I want to ask you about recruitment. How has that been? I mean, how diverse, first of all, are Iowa's sheriff's departments?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad you went there, because we're not very diverse, and we try to be. We've reached out to the leaders of minority communities in our area, and the sheriff has said many times, send me your applicants, bring them to us, please get them the information. We hold open houses when we hire, and we just did a hiring process in June. 25 years ago when I applied, I think we had 300 people apply for three positions. We've averaged over the last 8 years at least over 100 applicants, or right close to that. When we did applications in May for a June testing, we got 29 people to show up.
So what do you attribute that to? Is that because of the problems with the police, law enforcement relationship with the community the past 2 years, spotlight on this issue?
I think absolutely. It's gone down dramatically, and on two fronts. One, people realize this is a very dangerous job, and maybe they don't want to put themselves in that position. But I think even hurting us more is that cops really aren't viewed very favorably anymore. That cop that's on the world news acting inappropriately gets played over and over and over, but we never see the cop on the world news getting played over and over and over again when they're changing someone's tire on the side of the road because it's an elderly couple and they, you know, they don't want to wait for a tow truck, and it's just easier to help them out and change the tire.
Right.
Or just the other week, our deputies giving a transient person a ride across the county because they just didn't have any other way to get it done, and instead of leaving this poor person out there where they are, and the deputies that give money out of their own pocket to help people, those things don't get the news that I think they should. I wish the media, national media, would look as hard at cops doing good things as they do doing wrong things.
Well, I guess that's just the nature of news, isn't it? That news reports on anomalies, things that we don't expect, and some of the dark side of things. So I understand your frustration, though, John.
And I think we need to put it back on ourselves. Law enforcement, we need to start getting out ahead of some of these stories and promoting ourselves. That's not something we're used to doing, but I think we do need to embrace social media instead of complain about it, and let people know the things that we are doing. And when somebody does wrong, we are going to take action, but we can't take action immediately. We've got to look at the facts and do a fair investigation.
Daniel Trelka, let me turn to you, Chief of Police in Waterloo. How has recruitment been affected by these latest controversies in the past couple of years, where police and community relationship has been under intense criticism and scrutiny?
It's been brutal. We generally 5 years ago we'd have 1-2 positions. We'd get 200 to 300 applicants. I think the last time we had about 80 people apply. The next step was we asked them to show up for a physical fitness test, and 40 people showed up. So it's a job that I think a lot of people are looking at, and they're saying, "Well, gosh, I don't want to put up with all that grief. I don't want it." And I'm personally invested in this profession from both sides. My youngest son is African American. He's a product of Waterloo. His mother's in prison. His father doesn't have the ability to care for him. So my wife and I adopted him from the community, legally adopted him. And I don't want to see anything bad happen to him, but I want to understand. It's a two-way street, and it's interesting how I look at life differently now. Because of my son.
Yeah, right. We have just a couple minutes left. I'll have to ask you to be brief here, but going out before we end this conversation, each of you, please, going forward, tell us where you hope we will be in the future, in the near future, hopefully, and what it will take to get there. Betty Andrews.
Well, I hope that there will be an understanding that being in support of the African-American community does not mean you are not in support of the police officers or the rest of the community. And I also agree with John about making sure that things are reported on the good side to that. And I think that also applies to the African-American community, because often we're portrayed as very negative in the media as well. So I think that, we have that in common. So.
Mm-hmm. John Kodar, where do you hope to be, and how do we get there?
I hope the negativity and the problems we've had recently will spur people to get involved. I think Chief Brown said it very well the other night. He said, become part of the solution. Serve your community and don't be part of the problem. We're hiring.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're hiring also, and I can't think of a better way for someone that thinks they're being, whether it be a minority group or person, individual, if they feel they're not being represented, become part of the problem. If you can't be a police officer or a deputy sheriff, then find another way to get involved and help your community.
Daniel Twelka, Chief of Police in Waterloo.
I'm optimistic, but I think there's going to be some rough road ahead before we things start getting better, because we need to engage in a brutally honest dialogue, everybody, every faction, but we need to continue that dialogue, but I'm optimistic.
Mm-hmm. What about legislation, such as the legislation that Betty Andrews mentioned there? Does that need to happen?
I think there needs to be some legislative changes, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm. Specifically, in just a second or two?
Well, I've worked in 3 different states now, and the one thing that I get hit with all the time is you're not disciplining your officers. You're not holding them accountable. The way Iowa's laws are set up, I'm limited in what I can reveal when I discipline an officer. We are disciplining them. I would like to be able to release more details.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Daniel Twelka, Chief of Police in Waterloo, John Kodar, President of the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association, and Betty Andrews, President of the Iowa-Nebraska chapter of the NAACP. John, Daniel, Betty, thank you so much for joining us with your insights this half hour.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we'll talk with legal experts Ryan Copemans and Rox Laird. We'll look back at 5 years with the Iowa Supreme Court under Chief Justice Mark Cady. Remember, it was in 2010 that Iowans voted against retaining 3 Iowa Supreme Court justices, including the Chief Justice, for their part in the ruling that legalized same-sex marriage. We'll talk about that when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Bernie endorses Hillary. The GOP grills Attorney General Lynch over Clinton's emails. Obama addresses the nation's racial tension in Dallas. And Donald Trump narrows his choice of running mates. Lots of politics to chew over this week. We'll be doing that tomorrow at this time on River to River. In 2010, Iowans voted against retaining 3 Iowa Supreme Court justices, including the Chief Justice, Marsha Ternus. That was the culmination of a successful campaign by religious conservatives to kick the justices off the bench who were up for retention for their part in legalizing same-sex marriage in the state. That was the 2009 Varnum case, if you remember. It marked perhaps the most significant turnover of justices in the history of Iowa's high court. 3 new justices were added, Justice Mark Cady took the court's helm as its Chief Justice. 5 years later, we want to find out about the dynamics of the court, how that has changed, what else has changed about the court. And this Thursday, the Cady Court at 5 is a panel discussion. Iowa Supreme Court under Chief Justice Mark Cady, after 5 years, will be held in Des Moines this coming Thursday. Ryan Copemans is with us, attorney at Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. Also, Rox Laird, former Register editorial writer who has focused on the courts. Ryan and Rox, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Okay.
Thanks.
Ryan, your involvement here, you sort of put this together, this event, right?
Yeah, well, Rox and me and Sarah Bowden here at IPR and Grant Rogers at the Register and then Todd Pettis and you, I guess, to some extent, right? So this is kind of a culmination of I've been on the show now for the last few years, and every year we talk about this court and what they've been doing. And with the big retention election in 2010 and now with another one coming up in 2016, we wanted to look back on the last 5 years and to see, you know, not only how the court has reacted in terms of its decisions, you know, what the opinions that come out every Friday, but how it reacted as an institution. You know, the judicial branch is the third branch of government. They have hundreds of employees. They have 100 counties across, 100 courthouses across Iowa's 99 counties. And so it's a look back at how the chief has managed that third branch of government and responded to the big turnover.
Mm-hmm. It's been, well, it's hard to believe it's been over five years since that 2010 election. Remind us of the significance of what happened in 2010 and perhaps how unprecedented it was.
So as you said, you know, the retention election, they voted to not retain the three justices that were on the Varnum decision that were up for retention that year. There are seven justices in total in the Iowa Supreme Court, so essentially that removed almost a majority. And as you said, that was unprecedented in Iowa. And really, it's an unprecedented event across the country for any state Supreme Court to have something like that happen. When you have a court like that with, you know, very strong personalities and you hear seven members and you replace just one of those individuals, it can change the dynamic of the court. It can change its personality. So when you remove almost half the court and replace it, well, then you're going to have a significant effect, and not only replace it, but replace it. We had to replace it with a new governor. Well, an old governor, new governor, right? Governor Bransett came in 2010, mm-hmm. and really that's the 5 year mark that we're looking at is really from 2011 when Governor Bransett appointed these three new members. How that changed it, what replacing almost a majority of the court did, and it really has been to some degree unprecedented. You have whereas before you had a court that was almost always unanimous. They always agreed with each other. And now we have a court that looks a lot more like the U.S. Supreme Court. There's voting blocks. They dissent a lot, almost in a third of their cases. That's almost 4 to 5 times as much dissent as there was under Chief Justice Turnus.
So you're saying ideologically the Iowa Supreme Court has become a lot like the U.S. with sort of left and right sides of it, and blocks that reliably stick together?
Exactly, left and right, and then the swing in the middle, right? So we have, and Chief Justice Cady has kind of played that role as Justice Zager has as well. And so, you know, there's a different opinions about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing to have these different voting blocks, these different ideologies. I'm a strong believer that it's a good thing, that when you have this kind of difference of opinion, that it makes everyone better off. It makes the opinions better off, and it's good because it shows the public that these are hard, difficult cases that they're deciding, and that there isn't necessarily one right or wrong answer. So in that way, perhaps more than many others, is this court has changed in its disagreement in the way they write back and forth to each other about that disagreement.
Rox Laird, if we had we have now more ideological blocks in the court, what did we have before the non-retention of three justices in 2010? How would you characterize it?
I agree with Ryan. You have more ideological division, and you have justices who are willing to disagree in print and state very forcefully why they disagree. But pardon me, one of the things that I think you need to keep in mind historically about this court is that it has changed more evolutionary over time. Probably the biggest change coming back in the mid-70s when the Iowa Court of Appeals was created, before that, you had 9 justices on the court, and they decided all of the cases that came, all of the appeals that came through, and they were cranking out so many opinions. Sometimes it took 2 years to get a case through. So the, when the Court of Appeals was created to take a lot of that workload off, the Supreme Court was downsized to 7, and they really kind of had much more time to focus on unique issues that had not been addressed before. And so I think, you know, the court became much more narrowly focused. And then during the Turnus era, there became some little more activism on the part of the Chief Justice and the court itself on some Fourth Amendment issues, where they carved out differences with the U.S. Supreme Court on things like search and seizure cases, basing those on the Iowa Constitution. So it wasn't necessarily a watershed at the beginning of the Katie Court. It was an evolutionary thing as well.
Mm-hmm. Ryan Copeland's, if we take ourselves back to, well, it was this, what was it, the Varnum decision was more or less in the spring of 2009, if I'm remembering right, and we didn't have a retention vote until 2010, the election then. It was interesting in one of the changes, very clearly, this court is much more transparent when we think about the run-up to that retention vote. The justices were very reticent. They didn't say anything in their defense, did they?
No, they didn't. And the Chief Justice now, I know, has vowed not to campaign again kind of in this upcoming retention election and this and that he's going to have in 2016. But so while they're not campaigning, they're not saying anything in their defense. What they are doing, what they have done since then, this is one of the things as an institution, what the Chief has done, is be more transparent about their job, about what they do. So this is, we've talked about this before. You know, they've been going out on the road. They've been hearing oral arguments in cities all across the state, not just here in Des Moines. They've been visiting schools. You see them doing things. The Chief Justice every year does a State of the Judiciary speech, and he's been focusing on not what the Supreme Court does, but what the judicial branch as a whole does, focusing on drug courts, on business courts. You know, this year he's talking about human trafficking issues. And so really he's kind of brought into light what the judicial branch does as a whole, not just what the Supreme Court does, not just their decisions, but how everyday Iowans are affected by decisions in courthouses across the state.
Mm-hmm. Do you think because of the vote, and they were no doubt surprised by the vote, that they felt that a number of Iowans didn't have an awareness of the role of the court system, the judicial branch in Iowa, Rox?
I think that's true. A lot of people, when it comes time for the retention elections, will ask, well, why should I vote for a judge or why should I vote against a judge? And it's always hard to answer that question because, you know, most people would say you don't want to vote a judge out based on a ruling that you disagree with. You know,
but that's what happened in this case.
It's exactly what happened, right.
Mm-hmm. And so you want to vote based on if the process was followed, is that a better way to describe it, or what you
should
be?
That could be one. When I used to write editorials on this subject, the thing that we always argued was that voters should decide whether this judge is fit overall for the job. You know, the Iowa State Bar Association does a poll of lawyers, and they ask lawyers, okay, to rate these judges based on how they run the courtroom, how they treat other lawyers, how they treat witnesses and defendants, just their overall fitness for the job, not on the basis of a specific ruling, which could maybe be 3 or 4 years old and people have forgotten about, or in this case, it could be one that was fairly recent.
1-866-780-9100 if you have a question about Iowa's high court for our guests, Rox Laird and Ryan Copeland's. Let's go to James in Des Moines. Hi, James.
Hello. The most disappointing thing about that after the removal of those 3 justices was the fact that Governor Branstad considered that as one vacancy and took all 9 recommendations in consideration in toto rather than 3 individual group of justices of three each for each vacancy, and I think that that swayed the court more in any one direction than anything else that could have been done.
Mm-hmm. James, let's get a comment from that. Ryan Copeman's.
So our,
do you see it that way?
Well, what he's speaking to is so that our process works is that we have a commission. Five or half the members are elected by Iowa's Barb, I mean by the licensed lawyers in the state. Half of them are selected by the governor. In this case, those members have been chosen by Governor Culver and Governor Vilsack. And then there is the most senior justice on the court is then chairs the panel. So that panel meets, and they met. After the retention election, and they send, if there's one vacancy, for example, they send three names. And there had not been this practice on the Supreme Court before where there were multiple vacancies. And so the question did come up is, do we send nine, 3 plus 3 plus 3, or do we send three groups of three? And he has to pick from those randomly, random, however they were placed into the groups. But there had been precedent before. When the Court of Appeals was created, of course, so there were all of the spots were vacant. They sent those names up in mass instead of carving them out for each individual one. So there had been precedent, and this is how the commission itself had chosen to do it. And he's correct that the governor did take it that way.
So Governor Branstad had his pick of the top three instead of sort of being a little bit more limited in his choices, three groups of three.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. James, thanks for your call from Des Moines. Any other questions? 1-866-780-9100. We're also on Facebook. Or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Tell us about some of the most important cases since we're reviewing the Cady first 5 years. Mark Cady, the Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court. Some of the most important cases, moments of the Cady Court so far. Rox Laird.
Well, I think once you get past the Varnum decision, this year's cases, I think, were probably some of the most interesting ones that we've seen over the past 5 years. Of course, maybe those are the freshest in our mind, but the question of whether felons have a right to vote after they've served their sentences was a challenging one for the court. But there's been a lot of interesting cases this term, and I don't know, Ryan has just recently compiled some mm-hmm. information on how the court has sort of broken down on those.
Yeah, Ryan?
Well, so there were some very interesting cases this year, like Rock said, and there have been throughout the 5 years, and this is another way in which the Iowa Supreme Court looks a lot more like the U.S. Supreme Court. We have had a lot more what I call blockbuster or big-ticket cases the last 5 years, you know, these interesting constitutional, political questions, anything from we had the same-sex marriage birth certificate case. We had whether there was a right to education. That was one of the first big split 4-3 cases that came out in 2012 from this Cady court. We had the Telemed abortion case last year. And, of course, this year, whether felons can vote. We had a case about defamation and campaign ads and First Amendment issues with campaign ads. And we have everything in between, even from, is a rooftop solar panel, is that a public utility? And can we have rooftop solar in the state? And then from what might seem to be the most more mundane but very important cases about alimony, child support, those kind of cases that Iowans really deal with every day. And so with that kind of the big ticket cases I've talked about, that's brought on something new as well, which is called amicus practice. It's special interest groups coming into Iowa. They aren't parties to the case or maybe Iowa special interest groups, and they are writing to the court and they're saying, this is what we want the rule to be. You have, for example, the NAACP, ACLU, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. All these kinds of groups like this have been actively participating. This is something that's happened in the U.S. Supreme Court for years, but it has been relatively new to Iowa. And so these groups see something in the Supreme Court. They see an opportunity, perhaps, that the court is willing to do things or that it has a lot of power to make law and answer these questions. And we've seen a lot more active practice mm-hmm. there.
Ryan, are there decisions that have been made in the past 5 years under Chief Justice Cady that probably, or you could say perhaps could have gone the other way had the old court members been intact and made them?
I hearken back to the first one, that case, King versus State. This is whether there was a right to education. It was actually a case that had been brought by some conservatives against the Culver administration. And the argument was you need to be more actively involved in these local community school districts. We have a situation where the communities are unequal. Some school districts are really good, some are really bad, and we need statewide standards and statewide funding for this. And the court, 4-3, said there is no right to education under Iowa law as you defined it. And if you look at how that vote broke down, I believe that the case would have turned out differently had the three justices remained on the court. I think perhaps that the voting rights case, the felon voting case that Rox just spoke about that happened this year, I mean, we can only speculate. But I think that at least two members who were removed from the court probably thought more like the dissenters in that case. And so, in other words, they would have said some felons should have a right to vote. The list probably goes on and on, and it depends on a large degree on where Chief Justice Katie falls, because I think really not a lot has changed with the opinions of the court. I think they have pretty much picked up where the Turnus Court left off, and most of the cases are consistent. It's just that now there are those dissenting votes that go along with it.
Mm-hmm. When we look toward the retention votes in this coming November election, Chief Justice Katie up for retention, did I understand that correctly?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Any other justices?
Justice Daryl Hecht and Justice Brent Apple, two of the others who were on the Varnum decision, and those are the only three that have not sat for retention since 2010 or since.
Okay, so
Varnum.
All three of these were in on the Varnum decision, all three, and then this will bring up the last of those who were on the Varnum decision that faced retention?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2012, Justice Wiggins, who was also on the Varnum decision, was up for retention election, and he was retained.
Right. Now that leads me to my next question. With the court doing what it is doing today, being more transparent, trying to raise awareness about the role its role, the role of the judicial branch in our system of government. Rox, Laird, would you say that the court, the Iowa court today, is more resilient against campaigns such as the one we saw against retention in 2010?
Only if you think in terms of the court, individual court members of the court individually and the court itself being much more proactive to get out into the community to tell its story. I saw some figures just the other day that they have they visited 21 communities since spring of 2011 after the retention election and held their oral arguments in like high school gyms, for example, or community centers. And then the justices go out and speak with high schools and college classrooms, and they've done 140 of those. And I think the fact that the court decided to open up the meetings of the Judicial Nominating Commission for the appellate courts was another effort on their part to kind of open up the process so people could see how it works. Now, whether any of these justices will campaign, I think will depend on whether a campaign springs up against them. It doesn't appear that there's anything on the horizon yet, but you never know. And I think they will make that decision individually.
Mm-hmm. Where do you weigh on this, Ryan? Should there be, we can't see anything on the horizon, as Rox just said, but a decision that is unpopular with a significant part of the population, would this court be better placed in a retention vote?
As opposed to where it was when in 2010?
Yep.
I believe so. I really think that getting out into the community has helped. And really what that has done is it's, if you want to think about in terms of a political election, is they have energized their base. And so they have gone out and done these things, been more transparent. And you see the Bar Association, you see these other kind of community groups be behind them in a way that they weren't behind them before. And it's not that they were against them. It's just that they weren't as energized. And I think they are on high alert now. I don't think we'll see a campaign, like Rox said, but I think they're ready for it, and I think one would likely fail.
Mm-hmm. We have less than a minute, but as the court evolves, do you see it evolving in the future in any certain directions, either of you?
Well, I think there will be vacancies. So, I mean, we're coming up now on a few of them. At least one of them can retire at any moment. The chief, he has his time in. He's put a lot of years in. And you'll have over the next 5 or 6 years probably half the court turn over. And so as we see another gubernatorial election and we see these voting blocks, we'll see, you know, what governor will come up, who will appoint them, and the court could look very different in 5 years.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much. This Thursday, Ryan and Rox will be taking part in a panel discussion of Iowa Supreme Court under Chief Justice Mark Cady after 5 years. That'll be at 4:30 in Des Moines. Where's the venue?
At 700 Walnut Street, the EMC Tower, third floor. See you there.
Okay, thanks. Ryan Copeman's attorney at Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. Rox Laird, former Register editorial writer who focuses on the courts. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth, with help from Lauren Knutson. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Remember, tomorrow, Politics Day, lots to chew over with our guests. I hope you'll be back then. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.